Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
From the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana, this is Larry Batson, and you are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this magical network we call Blog Talk Radio. We hope everyone's having a great evening, as most of the USA is enjoying very warm weather for this time of the year, and you will not hear a complaint from this one at all. So big hello to all of our listeners, especially New Zealand, Ireland, England. We've got a fantastic show planned tonight, returning to the program with his book that was just released in paperback. And when we say paperback, I think that's kind of underestimating what we have here. A spectacular book, Canyon of Dreams. Harvey Kubernick will be with us as we discuss the music of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Eagles, Linda Ronstadt, the Byrds. Going to be a fantastic hour, so we encourage you to stick around. Even a little music tonight, so it's all happening here on the Wild World. As always, handling the technical responsibilities, our studio producer, Melissa Hovey, technical engineer, Wayne Larson, Scott Carney is taking care of the music for us tonight, and from the massive Wild World News Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, the honorable, distinguished, and always humble Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Well, good evening, Mr. Batson. Hey, I wanted to ask you, I forgot, when can I look forward to moving the alligators out this year?
Well, I still don't trust the weather. We've had 80-degree weather, but we could still see snow in April. So
it's 63 degrees tonight.
I know it, and they're wanting to go outside, but we'll just have to take a look at the Farmer's Almanac and see what they say, and maybe next couple weeks, so...
All right, well, let me know, because I'm pretty excited.
I'll call you up. You can help. The following portion of Larry Batson's Wild World is brought to you by Alphabet Swamp, the new children's book by Cheryl and Larry Batson. Order your autographed copy today at www.larrytheanimalguy.com or send check or money order for $10 per copy to WES 4140 North, 600 West, Greencastle, Indiana, 46135. Shipping and handling is included.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
This is Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News. Beware, the Ides of March are upon us. It's the 15th, and it's time for the Wild World News. Well, as we were just talking, we've had a pretty mild winter here in Indianapolis, haven't we, in Indiana?
Yes, we have.
And your bears didn't really get to hibernate this year, did they?
Bears do not hibernate. I've said that over and over.
Well, not in this part of the, well, this year, not in this part of the country, but let's head off to Madison, Wisconsin. Now, this awakening is going on all across the United States. All right, now wildlife officials, now listen to this, are urging people to leave the bears alone as they emerge from hibernation. Now, the Department of Natural Resources wardens say that people are throwing food and crowding the bears and the sows with cubs. Now, one of the sows said that it was showing signs of aggressive behavior because people were throwing food at her children.
You know... That's about as stupid as one can be, and I don't think that behavior will ever change. Ask the National Park System.
I know. Please, people.
Don't
leave
feed
the bears alone.
Yeah, don't feed them.
Now, I hope everyone likes bugs, because this year you're going to see more than you've ever seen in the past few years. And one of the reasons is, as we've been reporting, the white nose syndrome, the bats. Now, here's the bad news. It's spread all across the United States. Millions of bats have died. And now that disease is heading south. We're going to Birmingham, Alabama. Now, the disease, the white nose syndrome that has killed millions of cave-dwelling bats in North America, has now been detected in Jackson County. It's furthest incursion into the south yet. Now that a fungal disease, the white nose syndrome, was found in Russell Cave, and if you've ever been to Russell Cave, it's really a beautiful, beautiful cave. But here's the bad news. Wildlife officials say the bats save farmers $3 million a year by eating insects. And without all the bats, it's going to be a banner year for the bugs.
Well, that's, you know, that's with every predator. You know, snakes eat mice, bats eat mosquitoes. So, and then when they're eradicated, coyotes eat rats or mice in the farmer's field, and, you know, farmers shoot them all the time, not even realizing that the old coyote's actually saving them money. So it's all, don't mess with Mother Nature.
That's right. Well, we've been saying that for years now, haven't we?
Yes.
All right, now, where would you guess they'd find a new species of frog?
Costa Rica.
Costa Rica, Panama, that would be my guess. Well, we're heading off to New York, New York.
Oh, my Lord.
Scientists have identified a new species of leopard frog in the city and the surrounding areas. Now, Rutgers University said that the not-yet-named frog has positively been identified on Staten Island.
Huh, that's interesting.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Who'd have thought?
You know, even in a major city like New York, there's new life.
Yeah.
All right. Now, as you know, I'm a Kansas boy. And for our readers who don't, listeners who don't know, Kansas, the name Kansas means people of the South Wind. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. Yeah, I do now.
I'm a person of the South Wind.
Oh, there you go.
Well, we're heading off to Garden City, Kansas. An ongoing drought prompted the state to temporarily move a bison herd from the Sand Sage Bison and Wildlife Area. The 40 bison were moved to Maxwell Wildlife Reserve in McPherson County. Now, 10 bison were left at the Sand Sage area so they could feed until enough forage grows for all of them to eat. Now, what do I always say? Smells like a wet buffalo.
Oh, yeah, you do. Among other things.
Yes, among other things. Well, if you ever wanted a little ass or a burrow,
yeah,
chance.
Uh-oh.
Yuma, Arizona wildlife officials plan to begin gathering 350 burrows from an area near Yuma and on the California-Arizona line between now and April the 9th. Now, 350 burros, they should be pretty easy to round up.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, the Bureau of Land Management expects the burro gathering in Yuma and Blythe, California, to take about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Okay, good luck with that.
Now, sure,
the burros,
yeah,
will be examined and then taken to a facility for adoption.
Mm.
So, if you ever wanted to adopt a burro, now's your chance.
Okay. Well, not right now.
All right. Now, here's something my grandfather always said to me. He always said, "Have you got worms?" And I always said, "Yeah, but I'm going fishing anyway."
That's right.
Springfield, Illinois. More than 60,000 trout will be stocked in the waterways as state officials prepare for an April 7th opening of trout fishing season. Now, the fishing begins at 5 a.m. that day, and anglers must have a fishing license and an inland trout stamp unless they're younger than 16, blind, disabled, or an active member of the military. And this is going on all across the United States, so check your local parks and recreation areas for their local fishing information.
We love fishing, and anything to get the youngsters outdoors. That's a good thing.
In fact, we've talked about this before. The kids get out so little anymore. They're making dirt pills. for the kids to take because they're not getting the enzymes from, you know, going out in the yard and eating a handful of mud.
Well.
All right, now here's an interesting story from Billings, Montana. Now, we reported on this. It's been several months ago, and things have changed, so we're giving an update. Zoo Montana in Billings is pushing back the date of its Winterfest fundraiser concert to April the 28th at the Babcock Theater due to the March 24th scheduling conflict. Now, the concert features actor and musician Dennis Quaid and the Sharks. General admission tickets are $58, and VI tickets, which include a dinner, reserved seats, and an after-show party, are $138. Dennis Quaid and the Sharks.
Oh, yeah. That'll be standing room only.
All right. Now, we gotta do this. But on a sad note, we lost a Doobie Brother.
I heard.
Yeah, longtime Doobie Brothers drummer, Michael Hasek, died of cancer at his home in Wyoming.
Wow.
The family was by his side, and they read a note, read a statement on the band's website that said, "Our thoughts and condolences go out to his family and loved ones. He'll be missed greatly." Now, Hasek played with the group from 1971 to 1973 and then rejoined the band in 87. And he was performing with them up until a couple of years ago until, he was struggling with the disease.
That's too bad, but I'm sure the Doobie Brothers will march on.
That's right, but we're going to miss him.
Yep.
All right, now here's two things to think about before you fall asleep tonight. All porcupines float in water.
Really?
Dragonflies have six legs, but they can't walk. All right, well, that's the Wild World News for March 15th.
Oh, once again, a fine job done by Dr. Henry Day and his Wild World News staff in Indianapolis, Indiana. We want to tell everyone to check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and our brand-new Facebook page, Larry the Animal Guy and Friends, filled with photos and information about our animal family. Also, RadioMom.fm and the home of the Radio Mom Shop, where you can save 50, 60, 70% on vacations, restaurants, and a variety of other goods and services. And why not listen to my show, The 70s on Sunday, 12 to 7 each Sunday at RadioMom.fm. Also, McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. We call it God's Country. Go to their website, info@McGregorMountainLodge.com. Those are a few of our underwriters that make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
That I can sell uptown by myself. I wouldn't have no boss, but I'd be raising my lonely dental floss. Well, I just might grow me some tea, but I'd leave somebody else. But then, on the other hand, I would keep the wax and melt it down, pluck some floss and swish it around. I'd have me a crop, and it'd be on top. That's why I'm moving to Montana.
Moving to Montana.
I'm just mad about saffron. A They call me Mellow Yellow.
Quite rightly.
They call me Mellow Yellow. I'm just mad about 14. I'm 14's mad about me.
Become a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on.
In the music business with rock and roll in the late 60s and 70s must have hung out there. A fantastic new book, Canyon of Dreams, The Magic and the Music of Laurel Canyon. And it's a great honor to have as our guest tonight, author extraordinaire Harvey Kubernick joins us. Good evening, Harvey.
Good evening, Larry.
Wow, that music.
You know, there is a timeless nature to this music, even if I try to deny it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it does transport you back to, you know, specific events, but so much of it is still sort of relevant today.
Well, it hasn't aged. I mean, with the popularity now of classic rock stations, these youngsters that tune into those stations are hearing the music that, there's nothing that original that comes out anymore, I mean.
No, I think, you know, there's a number of reasons for it, but even technically or sonically, you know, some of the music was made on 4-track or, you know, 8-track machines, and they were done, you know, in some labor-intensive situations. Nobody was taking a year and a half to make an album at the time.
It's all done pretty quick, and I think, like you said, that's pretty much why this music has, gosh, so it's so spiritual, so magic. I mean, well, the new book, by the way, I want to tell our listeners, is absolutely fabulous. This is just released in paperback, and as I mentioned to you, Harvey, my wife totally adores this book, and she's quite the critic, and it's just filled with so many wonderful stories, and some of them I hope we have a chance to talk about tonight. And as I leaf through the book, it just brings back all those wonderful years that tell me I'm glad I was born when I was born, and the music was the background of our lives, was all a part of it. This is just absolutely extraordinary.
Well, it was the music. It wasn't quite the music business yet. And you still had situations, and I'm sure, you know, this, you know, is quite obvious in Indiana, your home base or around the world where people are listening. It was a world where, you know, disc jockeys on the AM radio stations in the early days of FM radio, sort of, you know, 67 to 72,
mm-hmm.
had some form of autonomy or freedom. It was a world, you know, before radio consultants showed up and restrictive playlists, and often some of these DJs were playing some of their own records, you know, from their own record collection.
Sure.
And so everybody was sort of in this big drum circle together. I know it may sound corny and hippie-ish, and come on, I'm from Hollywood. But truly, we were all in the music together. We were all serving the music. The money was always there, but it wasn't the astronomical figures that exist today. And, you know, there might have been 300 or 3,000 people in the music business back then. Now there's 300,000 or 1.3 million. And it's a pretty congested situation now. Plus, what's really interesting, a lot of the current groups, maybe not in the electronica world, you know, they owe a lot of their own music, you know, that they what they do now from the people, the records that they listen to, their own collection or their parents' collection.
Sure.
And they'll probably be the first people to admit that. And so the book, I think, puts the, you know, the spotlight on how music started in this town in the late 40s as far as pop and rock, or getting the jazz and Central Avenue, and then getting in how the 60s developed with folk rock and acid rock and psych rock, and the well, I guess the term would be the nascent singer-songwriter starts emerging, and it works for me.
Well, we were talking before we came on the air, and I said one of the great things that we'd love to do when we grew up in the late 60s and 70s was to go to the local private individual owner record shop, not like the Best Buys and these mega shops that are now available. And you'd go through there and you would leaf through the albums, spend hours doing that.
Yes.
And there was countless albums I bought just by the cover. That doesn't happen anymore.
Part of it is, you know, up until the early 70s, you didn't have the big chain stores. They're called, you had the brick-and-mortar mom-and-pop specialty record shop. The record shop became the record store, became the chain outlet. And also you had the device known as the LP, especially in the heyday, where there were double gatefold records. And, you know, an album cover could draw you to go into your pocket and buy the record, even without hearing the music.
Yeah, and the albums were priced at, my recollection is $3.99, $4.99,
mm-hmm.
$5.99 if it was really expensive.
And also the period of music, you know, that a lot of people are intrigued with in this book, and I'm kind of talking maybe post-64 where the Beatles changed the game, mm-hmm. all the way, you know, through the, well, 70s and 80s. Let's just say that it was when the retail world kind of changed from the 45 single to the LP, the album,
mm-hmm.
you know, format. So that's another reason you'd buy records and there were 12 songs, six on each side of vinyl, and you weren't just buying some hit song with a B-side. I mean, the album, you know, came into prominence. And Hollywood is not a phony town. It's not plastic and laid back. It's an industry town. The facilities are here. The Dream Factory's here. Plus, everybody has, there's a guy in the book, Kirk Ingham, it's toward the end of the book, he talks about so many people have their own projections of Hollywood on the city of Hollywood. they get confused and derailed by the real music that comes out of this town. So when a character like me, a native Angeleno, finally gets a chance to be Peyton Manning, you know, and call the, and not only take the ball and throw it, but actually be the field general too,
sure.
You get a real different view of Hollywood and LA music that you've never heard or seen before, because I'm just a byproduct of the radio dial here in the record stores, and also I was, you know, at one time West Coast director of A&R for MCA Records. In fact, I worked with John Hyatt, who came from Indiana.
That's right.
So I just, you know, have a very strong attachment to this music, but so does everybody else out there.
And this area, Laurel Canyon, explain a little bit about the area. Someone that hasn't had the opportunity to go to L.A. and
the interesting thing about Laurel Canyon is that literally you could be – you're 3 minutes from Sunset Boulevard in West Hollywood, yet you get a little bit of a taste of the country and the rustic community and the hills and, you know, deer in the backyard. I mean, it really is a canyon area, but it's so adjacent to – the music business or the film studios or the nightclubs or the record studios and the music publisher world that you're literally 5, 10, 12 minutes away, you know, from your job if you're a musician or even a screenwriter. But it's a little bit of country, and it's very much a community that hasn't changed much, to tell you the truth. And it actually had an element of seclusion in it. And it was an open community. It wasn't some gated, closed, you know, protected, you know, world.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore you had a sense of community and brotherhood or sisterhood. And, you know, in the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s, people didn't lock their doors. People had a neighborhood aspect. All the houses are so close to each other. And it's a big sprawling world, Laurel Canyon, of houses that were built, you know, going back to the 30s and 40s when there were hunting lodges.
Hmm.
And then a lot of houses were quickly erected in the 50s. And then there were some new ordinances put in, I think, about 57, 59, where you started having modern housing built. But it kind of is a world between the San Fernando Valley and West Hollywood. And, you know, I think, you know, the area had a slight impact on the music made in Laurel Canyon simply because it was a very little policed neighborhood. I have a guy in the book, a DJ named Elliot Mintz,
mm-hmm.
explains people may have these wild misconceptions of crazy parties and orgies and stuff in Laurel Canyon, which, by the way, I'm sure went down. But for many years, the security in Laurel Canyon or the law enforcement consisted of a couple of guys on bikes from West Tech Security. So the people in Laurel Canyon were sort of left alone, and that the people down below, the hippies, the kids, the long hairs, people not in the dominant culture, the police and the cops, you know, were more concerned with them about IDs, curfew, do you have any marijuana on you? And they left the real party people alone, you know, right up in the hills.
Sure. Well, I know it's still filled with artists because Jim Steinfeld lives in Laurel Canyon. He's been
he
on the
sure
show.
He sure does. The photographer Jim Steinfeld, who does music as well, and he does. And he's, I was at his house yesterday.
Oh wow!
And he really lives way up in Laurel Canyon. It's just great to look down and Laurel Canyon. He was attracted to come from Minneapolis. That's another thing. A lot of people come from other places, the Midwest and things like that, to come to Laurel Canyon, because it gives them a little bit of a sense of the world they grew up from, if they were from the farm or had a ranch, or it's not all cement. And there's no adjacent freeway. And, you know, it still works for a lot of people, although the price of property from rentals to ownership is at least 20 times what it was 30 and 40 years ago.
I wonder how many folks that move into that area and rent or buy have any idea of the history behind it or who may have lived in their home beforehand?
I must tell you, there's two elementary schools or one prominent one, and I spend a lot of time there at the Canyon Store or friends of mine that have mm-hmm. places. And I would say 90% of the kids making music are doing the computer or into electronica, rap. It's not I've got a band, four-piece band, groups recording. They don't have that sense of legacy and heritage or history, or nor should they.
Mm-hmm.
They're byproducts of what, like EA video games and the big franchise movies and synthesizers and keyboards and raves. And it's, you know, they're just not coming out of a world of people that were born and raised in L.A., or in the case of Jim Morrison, you know, came from Florida or San Diego and relocated to UCLA and then Laurel Canyon briefly. It's a whole different world, and we are going back 40 and 45 years now. I mean, to me, Laurel Canyon is important because I went to high school, oh, I don't know, maybe 2 miles at the most from Laurel Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I learned to ride a skateboard in Laurel Canyon. I had, like, a small paper route in Laurel Canyon. I mean, in fact, our high school, Fairfax High School, a very well-known high school in West Hollywood. I mean, so many musicians from Can't Heat and Phil Spector and Russ Titelman, the songwriter, and Wild Man Fisher, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers were formed at Fairfax High School. We took our driver's education class in Laurel Canyon. I mean, so there were a lot of winding hills to go through.
Oh.
So, I mean, so to me, Laurel Canyon has always kind of it's been like the back lot of my movie life. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And maybe that's why the book is just so potent, because, you know, a native Angeleno got a chance to take some snaps this time and also, you know, put the colors in and pick the photos and coordinate, and I mean, this book keeps, you know, spreading. This book has magic. This book, I think, has helped redefine what people think about Hollywood and L.A. as well. And I mean, in the process, they may discover who I am. But I put the focus on the music, and if it makes somebody check out the doors and go a little bit deeper than just light my fire or break on through to the other side, and if it makes people maybe discover the music of love or even Three Dog Night, you know, then I'm really happy about that. I'm on this planet to turn people on to music, always have been, and I think this book has been doing that. And really, it actually, when you really spend time with this book, and it takes a month to read this book. I mean, it's just too much. It's just too much. And also, in the true hippie sense, the book is quite affordable. I mean, it's probably going for less than $20 on Amazon. And even the hardcover was not even over $30. So it was done so, like, there was a lot of value that you could lay money out for. I said to everybody, look, I'd rather see 3 books go out there with tax, you know, for under $100, then 2 books going out there at, you know, $50 each at around for the $100. Because that one book can turn 4 other people on and create foot traffic. And, you know, I like to believe in that. I went into a bookstore in Sunset Boulevard in West Hollywood the other day, you know, and they have the hardcover copy, they have the paperback, they have some of my other books, including the Monterey Pop book that I do for my brother Kenneth.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden there's like this Harvey Kubernick section in a bookstore.
Isn't that great?
A guy that had to go to City College, Junior College, take dumbbell English, never wrote for the school newspaper, you know, no communication skills whatsoever. And I'm sitting there like, you know, with like next to authors selling like Joan Didion and stuff like that. I mean, it's really kind of a trip for me because I never wanted any of this. It sort of came to me. I had no dreams or plans to be a writer or anything, honestly. And any time I would think about it, about 50 people would gang tackle me and say, you can't do this. You don't know what you're doing. And I didn't get the usual encouragement or counseling or anything, except I know music, I know rock and roll, I have passion, and that's probably what has pulled me through, that my devotion, you know, to the spiritual aspect of this music has set up at least some literary things, and in the process, hopefully, you know, turn people on to some really good stuff, you know?
Absolutely. Our guest tonight, Harvey Kubernick, his book, Canyon of Dreams, The Magic and the Music of Floral Canyon. We're going to take a short break, get you a nice beverage, everyone. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. We will be right back.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting?
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second, I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Here's a hot topic about our wildlands and living with the natural role of fire.
Yard work is not just a matter of pride when you live in the wildland-urban interface. It's also about survival. Here are some FireWise tips that can help protect your home from wildland fire. Prune your trees 6 to 10 feet above the ground. Remove dead leaves and branches and dispose of them before fire season. Water your lawn regularly and store firewood away from the house. Be prepared for a fire emergency by having a plan for your family and pets. Learn more at our website, and then sit back and enjoy. You worked for it.
This hot topic was made possible by the Teresa and H. John Hines III Foundation. Learn more about the natural role of fire, how to protect your community, and get the latest fire information. Visit the National Interagency Fire Center website at NIFC.gov. That's NIFC.gov.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
This is Larry Batson. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to get back to Harvey Kubernick in just a moment. We want to tell everyone that next week on the program, a very popular guest, and we're going to the world of morel mushrooms, because here in the Midwest, the warm weather that we've had, maybe just a little bit of rainfall, those little guys will be popping up out of the ground. Mark Kitchell will be with us. And I tell you, the man is, you talk about having a passion for doing something, he loves to collect mushrooms, the edible type. So that's next week on the program, and we're looking forward to that. Also, a big thank you to iKidsFishing.com. It's the first kids fishing show in the USA, starring kids, teaching kids how to fish. 40 million fishermen spending $45 billion a year. The iKids Fishing Show is a keeper. More info at We Want You Cottages at Chautauqua Lake in western New York. Their website, www.wewantyou.com. One of America's finest fishing resorts. We also remind everyone, while we're talking about western New York, the first annual Chautauqua Lake Bigfoot Expo happening May 6th at the Chautauqua Suites in Mayville, New York. From the Discovery Channel's Monster Quest, Melissa Hubby, Steve Calls will be there. Bigfoot researcher from Virginia, Billy Willard, and yours truly. Have a great time there, and also the Wild World staff will all be there. More info at ChautauquaLakeBigfoot.com. Let me give you that phone number. You can make reservations, buy your tickets now, 716-789-3383. Also, Tire Service Plus and owner Jerry Jones, taking care of America's auto maintenance needs. They keep our animal truck on the road, traveling thousands of miles with our wild animal ambassadors. In fact, we'll be going in the morning. Call them at 317-243-0700. And a big thank you to all the individual underwriters that do support us. Go to my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and contact me. I'll tell you how easy it is to be a supporter, and we do appreciate that. So listeners from around the world can enjoy our program, our fantastic guests that we have each week, and we hope you do enjoy the show because we sure have a ball doing it. Those are a few of our underwriters that make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
Beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
I've ever heard somebody say phenomenal part of the world without some sort of caveat or backhanded compliment. That felt really good.
Well, thanks, Harvey. I have to tell you, I got cold chills during that music set.
The music, I haven't done the full forensic, you know, full body scan study of this.
Mm-hmm.
But look, we all know a lot of music resonates with everybody. Somebody may have the same feeling for Trent Reznor or Brandi Carlile or Lucinda Williams or Tool or Mumford & Sons.
Mm-hmm.
We're not discounting that, are we? Or the
no.
Black Keys. Okay. Except, sorry, folks, these people helped create the template. They expanded the league from 8 teams to 32 teams. They expanded the facilities, the income, the cash flow, the tickets, the venues, the record labels. This music and these people in this book set the game up so we all benefit to this day, even now.
Simply, they did it.
Am I like stumping too hard, like Theodore Roosevelt? Or I mean, I
no.
think you feel the same way.
Oh, absolutely, I do. I listen to the new music now, and I'll hear tidbits of artists from the past that I'm thinking, oh, that riff came from Hendrix or
including sampling. I mean, what happens is that everybody today grew up on this music and learned to play from these records or their music teachers. How many female singer-songwriters today did not learn from Laura Nyro, let alone Carole King's Tapestry album?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you do a record like Tapestry that Lou Adler produced, and I think it sold 24 million copies.
A record.
And that's why I gave it its own chapter in the Canyon book, and it was formed in Laurel Canyon and recorded in, you know, Hollywood. I'm sorry, but it's sort of like, it's something Bill Walton, the basketball player, told me many years ago. I was friends with him, and I'm quite fond of him. And it's a tremendous achievement to watch a basketball game with him before he became like a broadcaster on television. And he told me something 20 years ago, and he said, you know, the players in the next century are going to be even better than the people we've seen in the 60s, 70s, and 90s, partly due to nutrition and athletics and teaching.
Mm-hmm.
But also the players in the next century will have the benefit of watching so much film, television, cable TV. They'll have seen so much more basketball on television that you become a better player by watching things on television.
Yeah.
And I actually think the people today making music, they had to have been exposed to this music, either on reissue or re-release or box sets or greatest hits or cover versions, that it sort of seeps into the music today. And but there's just something deeper. I think somebody pointed this out to me, even recently. I mean, I've kind of known this, but it was reinforced to me, that a lot of the music made in the 50s and well into the 60s was either on two-track or four-track machines, or the bands played together and there was very little overdubbing. I mean, now somebody can be sampled or play an overdub and not be in the same country with the person. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm all for John Cage, you know, chance procedure, you know, movement. But something happens when people harmonize and make music together in a single sound source.
Well, I these artists had to work a lot harder, especially when it becomes to live performance. Because now with the artists, you don't know what's pre-recorded, what's lip-sync.
Mm-hmm.
And those, I can remember Harvey going to concerts in late 60s and 70s and thinking to yourself, boy, I hope the sound system's good tonight. Or they're in a good mood. Now,
yes.
You know, They just basically show up, and it with the advanced electronics, it just doesn't seem fair anymore. I mean,
well, also the people that were getting record deals then, you really had to break your neck to get a record made many years ago. You didn't
mm-hmm.
have the plethora of independent labels. I mean, you always had independent labels. In fact, they were the companies that usually, you know, whether it be, you know, Sun Records with Sam Phillips with Sun, or the Chess Brothers with Chess Records. I mean, the independents always nurtured, developed, found, and recorded, you know, a lot of the great people who either swallowed up by majors or remained independent.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about this music. I think the people had to spend a lot of time on the road. and do a lot of gigs or dance TV shows and personal appearances at record hops and things like that. It sounds so archaic to the youngins listening to just how hard it was for us to even go see a concert once every few weeks, you know, 40 years ago. I mean, economically, who the hell had $6.50? You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
But I think, you know, and I try to check out a lot of the new music, but I keep going back to this music because I have a feeling the engineers and the producers and the recording facilities and the use of analog tape as opposed to digital, you know, DAP
sure.
stuff makes a difference or made a difference. That's just, you know, my feeling. And I also in this book had to find the corresponding visuals to reinforce and augment the narrative text and the interviews with everybody. So I encourage people, if you like rock and roll, I encourage anybody to check the book out, get it through Amazon. It's available through Barnes & Noble. It will enrich your life, and you'll also get broke because of this book, because it'll make you go buy records and not download them because you're going to want the liner notes and everything else with it. So if you want to go on that journey, baby, check it out.
Oh, and the artists, there's some very intriguing stories. One of the people that happens to be in the book have been guests on our show, and that's the Dragon Brothers.
That was a joy kind of rediscovering them and realizing that the Dragons, Daryl Dragon, Dennis Dragon, and Doug Dragon, they're the sons of the composer, Carmen Dragon, who ran the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra and also did the music for the Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
There you go.
And people may know Daryl Dragon from his work with Captain and Tennille or Dennis Dragon when he was in the Surf Bunks. But the Dragon family really had been part of the music scene in this town from the very late 50s and have had a career not nearly as documented or well-known as the Wilsons, i.e. the Beach Boy Brothers. But they really could only have grown up and been part of the LA sound. And I gave them a chapter in the book as well as, you know, chapter profiles on, oh, people like Don Randy, a keyboardist who's in the Wrecking Crew. I mean, I put some heat over on the keyboardists and the drummers of the music. In my life, it's not always about the lead singer of the band.
Right.
The lead singer of the band. I'm the lead singer of the band. The lead singer of the band usually doesn't have the recall that the keyboardist or the drummer has. So girls and boys out there,
yes,
get to know the drummer or the keyboardist. Embrace them a little bit because they have the best anecdotes, the best stories. Didn't party as much because they had to be the responsible people to keep the beat or come up with the arrangements.
Sure.
And so I think does
ahead.
That make sense to you? So I think the book kind of shows some of that as well.
Well, it absolutely does make sense because we have had on keyboard players and drummers here on this show, and you're right, they have great stories. And they remember
But they're
that,
not.
Huh?
It's not as the media doesn't find them as romantic or shall we say dysfunctional, or the loser, or the rock star, you know, journey. But they're part of the band, too. In the case of maybe Ray Manzarek or the Doors, they helped put the band together. So I think I put a little heat on those people, and I think that's the secret tunnel of this book, that you find out about people you've never heard of, but you also... You know, the best I can tell you, if I made a conscious decision to talk to the keyboardist of the group, The Seeds, who, you know, had the hit single Pushing Too Hard and Mr. Farmer.
Sure.
And I would say 99% of everybody out there who's ever written about The Seeds just focus on Sky Saxon, the former co-founder and lead singer.
Mm-hmm.
I just chose to want to speak to the keyboardist who wrote a handful of songs and is still on the planet, and had some fresh tales to tell. So I think those are the things that win for me. Winning in the sense, if you're going to be Harvey Kubernick and you're going to chronicle a world that's between 50 and 10 years old, that's been done countless times in soundtrack albums or movies or documentaries and other kind of LA books, you better bring something new to the table. So I put in the 4-point shot in the basketball game.
You absolutely did. I mean, I've been such a fan of this music, well, forever, but the intriguing stories, one of the interesting artists that lived in Laurel Canyon and who proved to be, well, he is a fantastic musician and quite eccentric, was Frank Zappa.
Mm-hmm.
And I can still remember Dennis when he was on the show, when he's quite the drummer.
Yes.
And is it Dennis or Doug?
Dennis, and actually Zappa asked Dennis Dragon to join the Mothers of Invention.
Yeah.
Because they were both Capricorns.
And Dennis relayed to the conversation. Frank said, in his voice, I heard you were a pretty good drummer. He says, well, yeah, I've played with this. And Frank's next question to him is, can you read music? And Dennis says, no. Click. He hung up.
Yeah.
I mean.
Well, the only thing to top that story, and a portion of it's in this Canyon of Dreams book, Dennis Dragon for a while was a percussionist with the Beach Boys, and I'm talking like 69 to 73. He was on and off working with them, actually as early as late 68. And there was a 6-week U.S. tour in 1968, the Buffalo Springfield, the Strawberry Alarm Clock, and one other group, Buffalo Springfield and Strawberry Alarm Clock, and one other band was on this tour. Well, the Beach Boys, to tell you the truth.
There was
one other band. There was another fourth group. At the end of the tour, Stephen Stills asked Dennis Dragon if he'd like to be the drummer of a new group he was putting together with David Crosby of the Byrds, because they had done some recording in 68, a demo under a group called the Frozen Noses. This is just before Crosby, Stills, and Nash were formally in motion.
Mm-hmm.
And Dennis said, no, man, I need to go. I need to hang at the beach and go in the water all the time. So he turned down that gig.
Man.
But it's worked out okay. So I put in some interesting, you know, stories that I think are interesting.
Did we lose him? Hello. Dr. Day?